More than 80 years after Theodore Geisel, who wrote and illustrated under the pen name Dr. Seuss, published his first children's book, his books continue to resonate with readers of all ages. Total estimated sales for his books stand at more than $500 million and climbing. In his new book, Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel and the Making of an American Imagination, biographer Brian J. Jones examines the personal, professional, and creative life of this beloved children's book author, whose fun and easy rhymes and whimsical illustrations have delighted and resonated with generations of readers. Again, the name of the new book is Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel and the Making of an American Imagination. Brian J. Jones is the author of Jim Henson, the biography, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
It's very nice to have you on the program. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. It is, it's fascinating. I assume, like most of us, I was a huge Dr. Seuss fan, so reading this story is really interesting, and I found your job just to be beautiful. Give me an idea of the tone that you set of this idea of not so much a cradle-to-grave biography, but more going into that idea of becoming the man that we ultimately, I was going to say that we knew or thought that we knew of,
right,
as Dr. Seuss.
No, that's exactly right. And that was that was where the title Becoming Dr. Seuss came from. I didn't know anything about Dr. Seuss when I took this project on either. And what struck me the more I got into it is how you really can see him evolve in sort of three major arcs of his career. You know, he starts off very early in his career. He's, you know, this incredibly successful ad man. I mean, he comes up with this campaign for bug killer that would make Don Draper absolutely Grinch green with envy. A huge campaign for them, and doing stuff for Standard Oil, doing motorboats oil, and creates the Seuss Navy. So he's got this hugely successful career as an advertising man before he even ever considers writing kids' books. Gets into kids' books mainly because there's money on the table. It's something that's not prohibited under his contract with Standard Oil, and that's inspires him to write and to think that I Saw on Mulberry Street, not because he's got a compelling need to tell stories for kids, which comes later, but because there's money on the table. So, you know, that's sort of the first arc of his career, is getting into those books, mainly as a secondary source of income for him. But then as he moves through World War II and the 1940s and into the 1950s, really starts wanting to tell more compelling stories for children, and knows the power of those books for kids. And then finally, I think, fully becomes Dr. Seuss finally when he arrives at The Cat in the Hat. He's 53 when that book comes out. It takes him a long time to get to his big bestseller, but that's the moment when he grabs a hold of those sort of restrictive word lists that were in the Dick and Jane primers and runs with that and writes books that kids want to read, which was kind of unheard of in 1954. Dick and Jane were in the classroom and kids weren't reading them because they didn't enjoy the book. He took that same word list, made the books fun, and that's what really changed publishing and kids' books for the better. And that's really when he becomes the Dr. Seuss that we now know and love today. He didn't emerge fully formed, as we all think of. We've all grown up with him. He's always been there. I didn't know that whole backstory. That's what I found really appealing and fascinating about him.
Well, that whole idea of beginner books, that whole idea of reading with Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham, that was a market in and of itself. He was coming into a market very smartly of looking at something that could be changed, agonizing with the words that were put before him, and almost figuring out a puzzle to say, I can make an interesting story out of the very few words that I am given.
Yeah, he called it a literary straitjacket, but you're absolutely right. There were rules to these books, and so something like The Cat in the Hat, that was aimed at, you know, first, second graders, you know, people who had some reading skills, had one word list. But then you went to a book like Green Eggs and Ham, where it was what became beginner books, the word list was really restrictive, less than 200 words that you could use. And he talked about when he was getting ready to write Cat in the Hat, he thought, when he was told, write me a book that first graders can't put down, and they handed him the word list, he said, well, you know, this isn't going to be that hard. I'll just play around with it. It took him almost a year to come up with the subject of that book. And he finally said, you know, I'm going to look through this word list and just find two words that rhyme, and that's going to be my story. We very nearly got the tall ball. So thank goodness he decided Cat in the Hat worked much better. But that's, you know, it was that pedagogy behind it that made it the books, that's the reason teachers love them. But then parents and kids, you know, the kids didn't care about the pedagogy. The kids just cared that they were fun. And the parents were so happy to have a book to read to the kids that didn't say, see the ball is red, red, red. So really just kicked the door in on children's books. Very wisely, you know, recognized that we had the World War II generation back. The baby boomers were coming into their own. That, he was aiming it right at that audience.
Also, and then came the idea that he was able to just make up words, to make up things that rhymed, that were fun, that, as you say, I mean, obviously they appealed to the baby boomers, but they appealed to kids too. They sounded fun. They were fun to say. And right. That was...
And the baby boomers were the kids at the time. So,
right.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. But even now, I mean, even now looking at the people who read them to their kids, to allowing these books to go on and become parts of the library of every child in future generations.
Well, and the really cool thing about him is, you know, making up names for him, this may be crazy. For him, it was so easy. He would joke about it. It was so easy to him. People would say, where do you come up with these weird names? And he'd say, you know, I drew a picture of the Lorax, and that's what he was. So that's why he's the Lorax. You know, or he'd say, I actually have them in a book at home, and I just have to look up how to spell them. I mean, these really frustratingly flip answers. But what's really astounding about those words, you know, he comes up with a word like Grinch that sounds like it actually existed before. You know, it's really tough to come up with these organic-sounding names. I mean, if you ever try to do that yourself, we come up with these weird higgledy-piggledy words that are hard to say. So he's really, really fantastic at that. Once he gets into his books that, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to adhere to that rigid word list, that's when he can really, really let go and stretch and just comes up with just really incredible stuff.
Interesting side fact that If I Ran the Zoo was the first time the word nerd was ever in print.
Yes, and it wasn't defined the way we think of it now today. It looks sort of like an angry bird more than anything else. But, yeah, that's the first time nerd ever appears in print. And it was co-opted and became the word that we think of it very quickly, actually. Newsweek had it, I think, only several years later, and it was already, you know, coming into the meaning that we think of.
At what point did his career start to take off? Was it the Cat in the Hat that was really the start of, like, wow, this is lightning in a bottle?
Yeah, that's right, because at the time he was working on Cat in the Hat, he had done 11 books. He ended up doing more than 40 in his lifetime, but none had been huge sellers. Horton Hatches the Egg was probably his biggest book before that, but none of the books were selling well enough for him to write full time. So when he finally comes up with The Cat in the Hat, that's his million seller, and that's his blockbuster, and that's the book that also then floats all other Dr. Seuss books. Everybody goes back and starts buying his back catalog. So that's the book that breaks it open, that lets him finally start writing kids' books full-time, doing just that. He could stop doing advertising work because he was still picking up ad work until then. This all happens in 1957. Again, he's 53 years old by the time he gets his first blockbuster, so it's really kind of a study in stick-to-itiveness as well.
I was last week. I was off, and I was in Texas, and with my brother and I, and we were going through presidential libraries. And the first one we stopped at was the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library and Museum, mm-hmm. in Austin, Texas. I'm walking through. It's up on the top floor, and there's a whole case of stuff and of gifts that were given to the president. And back, buried in the back, is original art from the Lorax, and then there's this little placard that says that that Dr. Seuss that Lady Bird Johnson had asked Dr. Seuss if he would consider donating the art to the museum, and then there was nothing. Then I didn't see anything about it, and I would have thought, well, why don't they have the whole book up if they own it? Why? Why don't they have this all on display? And then it wasn't until I'm reading your book 2 days later that you talk about Dr. Seuss actually went to the Johnson Museum to gift the art to the museum.
Yeah, and everybody joked that he was the most popular person there for the day.
Well, sure.
So, yeah, they asked him, and he gave it to him because they had read it and understood, you know, the ecological message behind it, which was he often said that that was the one book in his career he wrote because he got mad. He'd been looking out the window of his studio in La Jolla and was watching cookie-cutter apartments sort of encroaching along this previously pristine hillside and wanted to say something about, you know, he always said, I'm not out to tell everyone to stop cutting down trees. I write books that are printed on paper, for crying out loud. But, you know, we need to manage what we have responsibly. And so that was, you know, the Lorax was him intentionally writing a bit of propaganda. And he talked about, you know, having done advertising work, he was pretty good at propaganda. So anyway, the Johnsons had an early copy of it and really responded strongly to it. So I think he was happy to put it someplace where he knew they would take good care of it.
The other thing is that you write in the book in that chapter about the Lorax is that he was sort of waiting for a shoe to drop of that the book would be seen as anti-big business. That never really happened, but he was concerned about it.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's because, you know, it got banned in log-cutting communities primarily, but I think that, you know, he was worried that that was what was coming and didn't really happen because I think a lot of people did understand he wasn't anti-business. And as he kept saying, you know, I live in a house. Houses are made out of trees. I'm not against cutting down trees. I'm against being wasteful with resources. So I think people actually got it. The book, when it first came out, didn't sell great, but it's one of those that just, you know, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. I think it's one of his strongest selling books still today, in fact.
And obviously The Grinch had a strong message, too, about commercialization. I mean, that was about business, too, right?
Definitely, which, again, it's interesting. It's almost an advertising man biting the hand that feeds him.
Sure.
in a way. You know, he's saying maybe Christmas doesn't come from a store. Well, he had spent the bulk of his career telling you that Christmas came from a store. So this was sort of antithetical to everything he'd done in his career up until then. But he had also really struggled with the ending of that book because he didn't want an ending that seemed overly preachy. He always said he didn't want to be intentionally preachy, except for, you know, the Lorax and probably Yurtle the Turtle, and really, really fussed around with that ending and finally comes up with that Brotherhood of Man ending where they all sit down and they eat the roast beast together. He didn't want it to be too, you know, overtly religious. He was really trying to make this a book anybody could read and enjoy, even though it had the word Christmas in the title.
You write about this in different sections of the book, but the he was married. His first wife was Helen Geisel, and she passed. You can talk a little bit about her death. Talk a little about the influence of her, because she was really very, very instrumental in working with him in the early stages of his career.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really hope comes through in the book, and that I'm proud of in it is I think Helen's role in his work can't be understated or underappreciated. She was the one, even when he was at Oxford, he met her while he was a terrible student at Oxford, and she was watching him doodling in his notebooks and said to him almost immediately, you know, you should be doing this. You don't want to be sitting here studying to be an English professor. That's a waste. You should be drawing things like this. So she's the one that really sort of inspires him to get into the game and become a cartoonist, which is the way he starts his career, submitting cartoons to humor magazines. But once he decides he wants to start writing children's books, she's the one whose opinion he trusts implicitly. She is the one person who can tell him no. She's the one person that can tell him if something doesn't work. He always said that she had the best sense of plot, the best sense of character, a perfect sense of knowing if a line was a clunker of a rhyme. She had this really great intuitive feel for his work, could tell him that if a drawing wasn't right. There's a moment in the book where he comes out with drawings from the Grinch and he says, you know, I've cracked this. And she says, no, you know, you've drawn them too small. They look like bugs. And he said, no, whose are bugs? And she said, whose are not bugs? Whose are people? You know, treat them like people. And he knew she was right. So, you know, her role in his story, I think, is so important. There's a reason when he creates the Beginner Books imprint with Phyllis Cerf that he asks Helen to join him as one of the three founding partners. Partly it's because he also wanted, if anything came to a vote, he wanted to be sure that he could outvote Phyllis 2-1. But, you know, knew that she had a great feel for the kinds of stories that he thought belonged in kids' books. She was a really talented writer in her own right, in fact.
Well, the book is fascinating, and it is just such a great read. It's Becoming Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, and the Making of an American Imagination. The book is published by Dutton. Brian J. Jones, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you being here.
Joe, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.